This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we head back into the past to learn about a radio station that might save our bacon if disaster strikes.
National Bureau of Standards, WWB, Fort Collins, Colorado. Next tone begins at 15 hours.
Plus, we look at an invasive grass species that could complicate wildfire season.
And we examine a recent study that could impact education policy in the state.
That's coming up. It's Tuesday, October 1st. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Colorado business leaders say they're pessimistic about the economy for the first time since 2011, which is according to the Leeds Business Confidence Index. It's been in positive or neutral territory since the recession ended, but has slipped into negative territory for the first time. Richard Wobbekin is senior economist at the University of Colorado Boulder with the Leeds School and joins us now to break things down. Richard, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me on.
For those who aren't familiar with the Leeds Business Confidence Index, or the LBCI. Can you just briefly explain what you're measuring with this and who you're talking to?
So we do a quarterly survey of business leaders around the state, and we ask them specifically what their plans are for hiring, for capital investments, what their outlook is for industry sales and industry profits, and then their outlook on the national economy overall and the state economy overall. And that combination is a weighted index that produces a number where 50 is a neutral, above 50 is an expansionary reading, and below 50 is a contractionary reading.
And so what we read this morning is that number has slipped below 50 for the first time since 2011. The economy has been pretty strong in Colorado for those last few years. Why are we seeing this dip in confidence right now?
I think it relates very much to the national economy. Our economy is still amongst the top 10. The Colorado economy is still amongst the top 10 growth economies in the country. So we can't really look at the numbers here in terms of employment growth or personal income growth or GDP growth and see anything but still positive indicators. But they're looking at the national economy. They're looking at some of the trade issues that are out there. And they give a very pessimistic reading on the national economy in this particular index.
And about 40% of participants cited the growing trade war with China. How much does that factor into business confidence here in the state?
Well, it's interesting because we're not a very large trade state, although we are proud of what we do. We certainly have trade in terms of agriculture and manufacturing and services. But that said, other states are more dependent on international trade than Colorado is. Just today, the Institute for Supply Management's national survey came out, also dipped below 50 in terms of their business confidence in the manufacturing sector. And in that particular index, the reading for international trade was all the way down at 40. So very pessimistic outlook at the national level for international trade.
Are you or other economists feeling worried about Colorado's economy?
Slowing. We see signs of it slowing, 2019 compared to 2018, and certainly going forth in 2020 as well. But that's a reflection of a slower national economy. We still expect to be a top 10 performing state. We still anticipate having a very low unemployment rate. So we're not worried, per se, about the state going into any sort of a recession. But we are concerned about the linkages between the national economy and the state economy.
And how do you see perhaps businesses responding in the next few months or maybe over the next year?
Well, I think we're already seeing some signs, as much as we can tell from the national data, that businesses have cut down on their what we call business fixed investment, their capital expenditures. They're sort of taking a little bit of a wait-and-see approach. We would expect similar behavior in Colorado, but we're hoping that the consumer continues to have a strong role in the economy and continues to keep the growth in the economy going, even while business is a little bit more tentative.
So we're hoping to see personal incomes continue to at least grow a little bit slowly.
Personal income has been growing at a pretty good pace. We're kind of a top 10 kind of personal income growth state. So we're really seeing the influence of very low unemployment rates and wage increases in the state, and certainly the overall GDP growth that I mentioned a little bit earlier.
I'm curious if you've noticed a difference between the way small businesses are responding to the national factors versus larger businesses?
Well, interestingly enough, in the survey, we do segment out the responses, and the small businesses are more pessimistic about the economy than the large businesses. Perhaps small businesses have seen a little bit of the caution of the consumer, or they've seen a little bit of the pullback by businesses in B2B investment. So they're the front wave, if you will, of the slowdown.
You have been putting out this index for quite a while, a number of years. What surprised you the most with this particular one?
Well, I was surprised it was so negative, given how strong the state economy has been. And even though we know that the state economy is slowing, it's still in very positive territory. And we're seeing that, again, by a lot of metrics, in addition to the things I've mentioned earlier, income and employment and GDP growth, we're also still seeing strong retail sales growth. So all of those things would indicate a much stronger state economy than seems to be reflected in the index. So I was surprised that it went as negative as it went and so quickly.
Anything else that you would like us to know? Any big takeaways?
Well, businesses don't like uncertainty. Well, you've heard it a thousand times before, but there's a lot of uncertainty in the economy right now, the trade uncertainty, the national political uncertainty, and I think the businesses are really reacting to the level of uncertainty, and they're becoming more cautious because of all of that uncertainty.
Richard Wobbekin is a senior economist at the University of Colorado Boulder. Rich, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And now a look at today's headlines.
A new report out of the state shows Colorado air pollution monitors detected nearly 24,000 leaks at oil and gas facilities last year. Most of the gas leaks were due to loose connectors, valves, and pressure relief devices at well sites. The report finds all of them have been repaired. While the number of leaks detected in 2018 increased from 2015, the overall number of well site inspections has also increased. The oil and gas industry says it's working harder internally to curb its emissions in the state.
Issue committees pushing for and against two measures on next month's ballots continue to raise money to try to sway public opinion ahead of November's election. Proposition DD would legalize sports betting in Colorado, and proponents have raised close to $1 million so far. They've spent most of that money on TV, radio, and digital ads in favor of the measure that would send new tax revenue to the Colorado Water Plan's priorities. Opponents are organized as a small-scale issue committee, which caps the amount of money it can raise and spend. They argue the water plan is flawed and shouldn't be given more funding.
Another ballot measure, Proposition CC, centers on the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. Supporters have raised nearly $2 million this cycle, mostly from groups focused on education funding. The ballot proposal allows the state to hold on to more tax revenue above caps spelled out in Tabor. Opponents of Prop CC say the measure would be the first step toward repealing Tabor and that it would harm the state. They've raised about $500,000 to defeat it.
Fort Collins internet provider Connection plans to offer high-speed internet to low-income residents for as low as $19.95 a month. The Coloradoan reports the reduced rate will be for households making about $42,000 a year for a family of four. The high-speed internet operated by the city is scheduled to roll out in the next 2 to 3 years. The Fort Collins City Council is expected to vote on the proposal later this month.
Wildfire is a continual threat in the West, but researchers say an invasive species of grass that's taking hold in states like Colorado, Wyoming, and Nevada could make things worse. For KUNC, Abigail Beckman has more.
Walking through a field near Westcliff, you'll find knee-high patches of sage, throngs of wildflowers like asters and Indian paintbrush, and cheatgrass. Guinevere Nelson is the Colorado State University Extension Agent for Custer County.
And you can see
she picks a handful of a reddish grassy plant, pointing to the bristly awns hanging from its stem.
This is the cheatgrass. So this is going to get into your socks and your shoes and your pants,
okay.
Just so you know.
Thanks for the
You're
heads up.
Welcome.
If that sounds familiar, you've likely encountered the invasive weed. According to the Bureau of Land Management, it's gradually taking over rangeland across the West. David Huber owns the nearly 400-acre ranch we're walking through.
As you can see the results of the fire. That fire was not a lightning fire. That was a camper that got away. They tried to find him for a while, but
In 2011, the Duckett Fire came dangerously close to his home, burning more than 4,000 acres of Forest Service, BLM, and private land. For him, managing cheatgrass isn't as big of a concern as wildfire prevention.
Inside our property, we've thinned considerably, and we've also limbed all the trees up about 5 or 6 feet. So if the grass does burn here, there's less of a chance of it putting the trees on fire.
His approach to fire mitigation may have to change, though, along with the approach of many others in the Wet Mountain Valley, if cheatgrass continues to spread. The thing about cheatgrass is it's highly flammable. It grows quickly in soil disturbed by grazing, tilling, development, and even fire. A blaze last year in Nevada, the Martin Fire, spread through cheatgrass and eventually claimed more than 435,000 acres. And with this year's wet spring, the weed is in full force. By this time of year, cheatgrass is dead. It turns a rusty brown color and becomes a thick, continuous, dry fuel that leaves behind a layer of seed on the ground that can be viable for as long as 4 years. Nelson says cheatgrass germinates faster than most native grasses, so it outcompetes them for space and nutrients.
People call it cheatgrass because it can have about 2 cycles that it'll grow, release seed, and then grow and release seed again.
It was originally brought over from Eurasia, most likely with grain, but it was also introduced in the 1800s as an anti-grazing grass, something livestock typically doesn't like to eat. So now places like Westcliff are left with stand after stand of a highly flammable, invasive weed that's really difficult to control and constantly looking to spread. Nelson says the worst-case scenario would be
just everything cheatgrass all the time, because it provides no real habitat for your bugs or your birds or any kind of reptiles or anything. It's of no ecological value to the systems here.
Landowners have a few options to deal with cheatgrass, including early grazing, pulling the weed out of the ground, and chemicals. Shannon Clark is a postdoctoral researcher in the Weed Research Lab at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. She's familiar with the ranch owned by David Huber. She did studies there, looking at the effects certain chemicals have on cheatgrass at high elevations. Clark says Colorado's cheatgrass problem isn't nearly as large as other western states.
So somewhere like the state of Nevada, where cheatgrass has been present for so long and has been able to get a hold of that ecosystem. The problem is now, if you go in to those areas, a lot of times the native plant community has just been eliminated from the area.
In Colorado, the Bureau of Land Management says cheatgrass on the land it manages is most prolific in northwestern portions of the state. Data from the University of Georgia shows it was found most abundantly in Boulder County, but cheatgrass has been observed across the entire state to varying degrees. Right now, the weed is classified as a C-list noxious weed in Colorado, so it's on the state's radar as a potential problem. Clark says the work it would take to get all of the landowners and relevant government agencies involved in a management plan could prove difficult.
I think that's the biggest hurdle, is just trying to bring everyone together, coming up with a strategy to start controlling it.
The BLM is currently studying a bacteria strain that could help control cheatgrass. In June, the Western Governors Association announced a partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to look for ways to address cheatgrass. Conversations are ongoing. In a statement, WGA policy advisor Bill Whitaker said the spread of cheatgrass has, quote, become a critical threat to healthy western rangelands, adding that it harms watersheds and diminishes wildlife habitat. I'm Abigail Beckman.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West News Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration. You can find more stories at KUNC.org.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC. New research was published in September that examines the impact that a full day of preschool has on children's school readiness. The research has a lot of people talking in Colorado because of its possible impact on education policy moving forward. Ann Shimke is a senior reporter with Chalkbeat Colorado and has been looking into the study. She joins us now to help us better understand it. Ann, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thank you.
What stands out to you? What are the major takeaways?
Full day preschool in this study had major benefits compared to half day preschool, particularly in the area of literacy. Also, in the areas of social emotional skills and physical development, but literacy was probably the key big success here. So specifically something called receptive vocabulary, which is all the words students understand and can apply to the world around them. And that's important because it's a building block for literacy in general. And literacy is really a building block for all other learning.
What do we know about previous research in this area?
What's significant about this research compared to previous research is this uses a high caliber methodology. It's really considered the gold standard methodology for things like this, a randomized control trial. And by using this, the researchers were able to isolate the effects of full day preschool versus students who lost the random lottery to get into full day. So you hear with a lot of research, well, correlation doesn't equal causation. That's not an issue with this particular study.
Okay. What made this situation in Westminster so unique and then so well suited for this research study?
What Westminster did 3 years ago was when they received private funding to open full-day preschool classrooms, they wanted to do a very robust third-party study of the effects of those full-day classrooms. First of all, that's atypical. They were doing this actually as part of a study to look at a new kind of financing mechanism. Now that the state is putting more money toward preschool, including full-day, that financing mechanism they were studying is less of a key issue here, but the results showing that full day preschool was effective, that is, I think, really what we've gleaned from what Westminster decided to do 3 years ago.
The study illustrates the importance of early childhood education. What do we know about the brain at that age?
What we know is that the brain is growing like crazy at that age. 0 to 3 even is when so many connections are being made in the brain, and that continues through 5 years old as well. So it's a key time for development and learning.
And of course, Governor Jared Polis has a great deal of interest in and is very supportive of early childhood initiatives. How do you think, you know, the knowledge gleaned from this study might factor into that?
This study definitely supports some of his agenda, which is very ambitious. This fall, he has instituted full day kindergarten for all Coloradans. Along with that, there's also thousands of new preschool slots in the state-funded program, which is for students with certain risk factors. And districts are using a lot of those slots to create full-day classrooms. Most kids in the state-funded program are in half-day classrooms, but these new slots are giving districts more flexibility this year than they've typically had.
And is there anything else that we should know about this?
I think generally speaking, this lends support in Colorado and beyond to the benefits of a full-day classroom. One thing that's worth noting is that the researchers plan to follow these preschoolers through at least third grade. And so there will be additional research coming down the pike on the whole issue of fade out and whether the gains realized by kindergarten fade out by second or third grade. So that research will be coming, and that's going to be an interesting addendum to what we have right now.
Ann Shimke is a senior reporter with Chalkbeat Colorado. Ann, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
100 years ago today, one of the oldest radio stations in the world was born, WWV. It's a part of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is America's keeper of many measures. And for a long time, generations really, WWV has been telling the time down to the second.
At the tone, 18 hours, 1 minute, coordinated universal time.
KUNC military and investigative reporter Michael DeJuana attended the anniversary celebration earlier today, and he joins us now with more on that and to tell us how WWV in Fort Collins could one day save the world. Bold statement there, Michael, especially considering few people have probably ever heard of WWV.
Yes, I'm confident in reporting that after my conversations with military and federal officials. Also, to ham radio operators who pick up the high frequency or shortwave, WWV is known around the world.
So I'm a little lost here. How can a station that tells us the time save the world?
Well, a little-known network took part in a live exercise with military, state, and county emergency officials across the country.
Your attention, please. The Tennessee National Guard and Tennessee Emergency Management.
In Tennessee,
communications exercise
in Ohio, and beyond.
Okay, that sounds pretty grainy.
Well, it's old school radio. Those recordings were provided to me by U.S. Northern Command in Colorado Springs. That's the military command in charge of Homeland Security.
Oh, so this is where you get into the saving the world part.
Yes. All those radio operators are part of a safety net in the event of a disaster, like, for instance, an electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear attack. I asked the chief of the Army's Military Auxiliary Radio System, which they call MARS, about this. His name is Paul English, and he gave the example of a catastrophe where the sun releases a mass of plasma with a magnetic field.
There have been instances where those coronal mass ejections could be so large that they have an adverse impact on electronics and communications.
Adverse impact on electronics. So like mobile phones?
Exactly. Computer screens going blank, vehicles that don't run, disruptions to banking, food and fuel supplies. It's an apocalyptic scenario.
And that's where our MARS operators will reach out to the amateur radio community, you know, located throughout the country, and just ask some simple questions.
Like, what are the lines like at hospitals? How are the roads? And so on. It's what the military calls situational awareness.
So what does all of that have to do with WWV?
Well, English put it this way.
With their high-power transmitters, we would look at WWV as a source to get out information.
So WWV has a role in assisting disaster and emergency preparedness and response with its broadcasts if needed. The test process with the military's MARS program began this year. The broadcasts in 37 states, 9 countries.
Mm. As we mentioned, you went to the 100th anniversary event for WWV. Tell us more about that.
There's an array of tall radio towers tucked away in the farmland north of Fort Collins. Those towers and the station are surrounded by security fences. I had to clear security to get to the celebration. And once inside, I met with Elizabeth Donnelly. She's the chief of the time and frequency division for NIST in Boulder. There's been talk of cuts to NIST, and that could impact the station. I asked her about it.
Over the past few years, there's been some big cuts that were threatened that didn't materialize so far.
And it gets complicated from there. Congress, haggling.
Okay, but these kind of budget concerns, did they get in the way of the celebration? I can't imagine.
No. There was a tent full of dozens of people, from the mayor of Fort Collins to ham radio operators, and a presentation from a MIT scientist, Philip Erickson, who said this old radio technology can be used by scientists around the world to crowdsource studies of our atmosphere.
WWV itself is a very important and future-oriented, by the way, remote sensing tool, much more than the convenient way to set a watch. For us, it's a real way to increase understanding of upper atmosphere variations, which are labeled space weather.
That sounds like way more science than we have time to get into right now. But before you go, I do want to touch on the history of WWV. How did it end up that Fort Collins is home to such an important station?
WWV got its start in Washington, D.C. by test broadcasting Friday evening concerts. Woodrow Wilson was president at the time, and it was a revolutionary idea. Later, the station provided agricultural reports. Eventually, it evolved into a station for standards, for example, broadcast frequencies, so radio operators could calibrate their radios. And those pulses are seconds, as some say, the heartbeat of the electromagnetic spectrum. They've been part of the broadcast since 1937, and an announcer stating the exact time was added in 1950, and that's linked to NIST's super-accurate clock. Since 1966, the station has been located in Fort Collins.
One last thing before we go here. I did wonder about the military auxiliary radio system, the Mars program that you mentioned. What I really want to know is, are the Mars operators called Martians?
You know, I asked the Army's Paul English about that. Here's what he said.
A common question, no. We like to call them Mars Auxiliaries because they are an auxiliary component to the Department of Defense.
All right. Michael DeJuana, thanks for sharing with us.
You're welcome.
If you want to learn more about WWV Radio in Fort Collins and the military's Mars program, visit KUNC.org.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll take a look at the legal marijuana market in Colorado 5 years later. I'm Aaron O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.